All right. So we have a couple of loose ends to pull together the end of chapter 7, which is where we're up to, and kind of summarize the end of the period of Shmuel. I know we're only in chapter 7, but we're really at the end of Shmuel's story, or at least the major part of Shmuel's story. I think last week we got up to the description of the battle, or the description that there was a second battle with the Plishtim, and Shmuel, after the victory of the battle, takes a stone, sets it as a monument, and he calls the stone Evan Ha'ezer, or Evan Ha'azer. That was in Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayamar Adhena Azaranu Hashem, and he said, "Till here, God has assisted us. God has been helped us." Here being both a place, a point of time, and a point of place. Actually, in English, also a little bit here can be a reference to place and a reference to time. Right? Less frequently, but in the word in Hebrew, the word Hena is both a reference to place and time. It's one of those unique words. And in context of Shmuel's message, he is really expressing a double message. One is that this time around, God was on our side, unlike the last time they fought the Plishtim, which was the first battle of Ebenezer, where the tide had been turned the other way. And number two, he points to this place, this stone, as a monument to their victory over the Plishtim. I think I showed you a map last week that this is not the same Evan Ha'ezer where the first battle took place, which was near Afek of Evan Ha'ezer along the border. This is Mitzpeh, where Shmuel is, which is in the middle of Shevet Binyamin, somewhere right here around Yericho. So the battle sort of takes us full circle. It starts with Afek, Evan Ha'ezer in the time of the first battle. The Mishkan goes south into the area, or the Aron goes south into the area of Eretz Plishtim, comes back to Beit Shemesh, which is on this map? Not on this map.
No.
Which is not on this map. The Aron ends up going into Giv'on, or the area of Kiryat Yarim. And then Shmuel, after the big campaign of Tshuva, comes back to Mitzpeh, brings an offering, offers prayer. The whole description that we talked about last week in terms of Shmuel standing on the mountain offering a prayer and a korban while the people are fighting in the battle down below, similar to, we compared it to the story of Moshe standing on the mountain at the battle of Amalek with the staff in his hand. All of that is over here, and then eventually renames the place, or takes a stone, a monument, and names the place Evan Ha'ezer. It's not the same Evan Ha'ezer as the first battle, but it's certainly named after the first battle's location, although with a twist. There it was just the name of a place where the battle took place and where they lost. And here, it's kind of the ironic twist. Adhena Azaranu Hashem. This is Evan Ha'ezer because this was the Ezra, this was the assistance, the battle in which God was on our side. And that leads us to Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayikanu haplishtim v'lo yasfu od lavo b'gvu Yisrael. Plishtim were subdued. Never again did they come into the borders of Israel. Essentially a description of the Plishtim in their role back in the days of Sefer Shoftim and their role back in moving forward into the time of David HaMelech. The Plishtim have a territory where they live down in Eretz Plishtim, Aza, Gat, Ekron, that area.
Ashdod
a little bit. But by the time we get to, by the time the story of Shmuel had taken place, the Plishtim had moved north and east into the heartland of Israel, into the mountains. Shmuel successfully pushes them back into into Eretz Plishtim, and there they'll stay. They'll continue to exist as a functional group, certainly through the time of David HaMelech, but not in any way that would pose an existential threat to the land of Israel, to the state, to the nation of
they
Israel.
They did defeat Shaul and kill Shaul in a battle.
There's a battle of Shaul and Har Gibeah. We'll talk about that, but essentially there is as an existential threat to Israel. Shmuel has pushed them back. Certainly during the time of Shmuel, God's hand was against the Plishtim, and they do not recur or come back, certainly during the time of Shmuel. Furthermore, the cities that the Plishtim had taken, Israelite cities that the Plishtim had taken from us, now returned to our hands. Me'akron v'ad gat v'ad gvulan hitzil Yisrael miyad plishtim. And there are territories within the land of the Plishtim that have now come under Israelite rule, Israelite control. The subjugation, the conquest of the Plishtim was far greater than what had initially been the borders. In other words, before the original border of Eben Ezer, the Plishtim were in the south, it began to move north. Now we've not only pushed them back, but actually moved further south into the territory of the Plishtim, so that the success of the Battle of Eben Ezer II was to achieve even more than where we stood before the Battle of Eben Ezer I. Somewhat analogous, if you want to put it in contemporary terms, to the Six-Day War, where we didn't want the battle to in the first place, but once it happened, so the success of the Israeli army was to achieve that which they had, or to regain that which they had lost in 1948. It's here the Battle of Eben Ezer I brought the Plishtim into the heartland of the country. Battle of Eben Ezer II essentially brought Israel back into those territories to reconquer and control. And then we have this very strange reference, Vayhi Shalom ben Yisrael uben ha'emori. Peace, therefore, was achieved between Israel and the Amorites. Where did they come into this picture? How do the Amorites come into the conversation? It's about the Plishtim.
Show us again where the Amorites
are. So that's the big question. To which Amorites are we referring to? Essentially, the term Emori is similar to the term Kna'ani, which is a generic term, which can be referred one of two things. It can either refer to one of the seven nations of Kna'an. There are seven nations of Kna'an. Kna'ani, Girgashi, Emori, Chivi, Prizi, Rusi. But there are places where the Torah does not refer to each of the seven nations specifically, but rather by a more generic title, either as Ame Kna'an, and sometimes by the generic term, the Emori. So the Emori and Kanani are almost synonymous with each other. They're used interchangeably to refer to various segments of the indigenous population of the land, what we refer to as the seven nations of Kanan. There is often a distinction made between the Kananim and the Emorim in the sense that, typically, especially after the conquest of Yehoshua, the Canaanites that are left on the plains and on the open fields, not in the mountains. The Amorites typically lived in the mountains. If you remember the Battle of Sichon, Moshe battles the people of the nation of Amor, or Amori, King Sichon, Melech Amori, in Chumash time still, in Parshat Chukat. And that is in this area here, land that had been originally taken from Ammon and Moab by Sichon. Israel had come and on their march from Yitzhak Mitzrayim had conquered that territory, or had asked to go through, and Sichon said no, so there was a major battle. The Amorites are here in the land of Moab, original land of Ammon and Moab. This is also mountainous, Hare Moab. So typically we refer to the Canaanites on the coast and the Amorites in the mountains. subdivide those two generic groups, and you'll get the specific subgroups: Girgashi, Yivusi, Givonim, Chitim, Pizim, etc. But overall, we have two generic names for the population. One is Knaanim, and the other was Emorim. Typically, they refer to those who live on the coast versus those who live in the mountains. Go back to Sefer Yehoshua and the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, and to all of the groups that had not, whose territory had not been conquered. Right, if you remember the conclusion of Sefer Yehoshua, in the opening chapter of Sefer Shoftim, was essentially an indictment to Israel for not having finished the job of the conquest of Canaan, and having left all of these different groups of Canaanites in the land of Israel, which they were supposed to remove, or at least bring into a context of abandoning the idolatry to create that idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel. They failed to do so, and from that point forward, they became, as the Torah describes it, thorns in our side. Meaning that there's the recurring theme of Sefer Shoftim is that there's a constant cultural influence from these nations into the people of Israel, and that's what's driving the idolatry. We're going to talk about that in a little while as well. But the message here is that as Shmuel successfully conquers the people of Eretz Plishtim, pushing them back, what does he accomplish? Two things. Certainly restores the Israelite cities that have been taken over the years. But secondly, Vahi Shalom ben Yisrael v'ena Emori. Although not described in detail, right, we have no record of the battles or of the events related to the Canaanites or the Amorites other than the battle with the Plishtim. What seems to be referring to is the fact that in the aftermath, Shmuel accomplished something else, which was to essentially finish that which was left unfinished in the time of Yehoshua and Shoftim, to achieve some kind of peace with the Amorites, or essentially to remove the idolatry, or to create some address to the rest of the Canaanite population of Canaan that had not yet been addressed properly in the time of Yehoshua and Shoftim.
You just get that from the fact that there was peace between Israel and Shoftim.
They were afraid. Can it be that Canaanites were just afraid to attack Israel as being a stronger military force? You can't tell from that one sentence.
True.
I mean, from this whole thing, you realize that Israel's always been a lover of peace and not wanting war.
I'm going to leave modern politics out of the biblical story for a moment.
I'm just saying, going way back, they didn't really.
I'm not sure that's the message here. Right. I think that
it's sort of like all's quiet on the Western Front, right?
True, but more significantly, right? Where there it says the land was quiet. Here is this actual shalom ben Yisrael of Emori. It's a much more definitive statement. The Plishtim are subdued. The Plishtim are back in their land. The Shalom ben Yisrael ben Emori, the Canaanites, the Amorites. There's a new relationship there. Maybe just because of the fear of the battle, but I think that there's ultimately an address to that which has been a major issue for all of these centuries.
But they're still there.
They are still there. Correct.
I mean, it doesn't say and they were conquered.
Right.
It says
right.
Were.
We don't know. Correct. We don't know if there are battles. They're still there, but I think that they are probably less of a role. Historically, from David HaMelech, Shaul and David and on, most of their challenges are external. We don't find, the exception of perhaps the Plishtim, we don't find the kind of internal, both cultural and military threats that we found in the period of the Shoftim, where every time they turn around, another stronghold of Canaanite population explodes into a fifth column, and suddenly we're fighting behind our backs. That you don't find. Shaul, David, they're fighting Ammon, Moab, the Aram, right? There's nations around them. But internally, with the exception of the Plishtim, you don't find that. And so I think that it's more than just a function of whether the populations are there and made peace with them. Now they're afraid of the strong arm of Israel. I think that there's a more substantial achievement in whatever manner it's not told to us, but a more substantial achievement vis-a-vis the address of the issues of Sefer Shoftim. Jumping a little bit ahead of myself, but I think that that's an important piece. Pasuk Devav, Vayishpot Shmuel et Yisrael kol yemei chayav. Shmuel judged Israel, led Israel. Remember the word Vayishpot. In the context of Sefer Shoftim, we are still in the continuation of Sefer Shoftim for all intents and purposes. Means that he led Israel both militarily, as we've seen, and spiritually. This is the significant, unique position of Shmuel as both a Navi and a Shofet. The last time we had anything close to the synergy of a Navi and a Shofet was Barak and Devorah, where you had a partnership between them. The last time we had an individual who served as both Navi and Shofet would take us all the way back to Moshe. והלך מדי שנה בשנה וסבב בית אל והגלגל והמצפה ושפט את ישראל את כל המקומות האלה. Shmuel was the itinerant shofet?
The circuit judge.
Right? First circuit judge in the history of humankind.
Because Abraham Lincoln used to be a circuit.
That's right.
He rode the circuit. Warriors did that, yeah.
That's right. So this was Shmuel's journey.
Starts in Ramah, which is in Eretz Binyamin. We'll talk about Ramah in a moment. And he begins the journey. What's the journey? What's the sequence? Beit El. Beit El is north. Gilgal.
Is east.
Gilgal is essentially...
by Jericho.
East. Gilgal east. Is here, east, near Jericho. Mitzpah comes back up here to the area of where Ebenezer was. It's possible that Mitzpah is referring to the Mitzpah of Yiftach, which is, if you remember, east of the Yarden. So it's he might be crossing the Yarden, coming into here and coming around, but he's certainly heading north and then east. V'shafatat Yisrael kol ha'mekamot ha'ele. And he judged Israel wherever he went. His leadership, his guidance, his rule. This is a description of Shmuel on an expansive tour every year. Uchuvato haramata kisham beto. Returning to Ramah. Ramah is the capital city of Shevet Binyamin, just north of Yerushalayim today.
Ramallah, maybe?
No, it's not quite Ramallah, but it's where. If you look out of Yerushalayim to the north, there's a hilltop, and you can see a little monument there, and they refer to it as Nebi Samuel, correct. So that's supposed to be the kever of Shmuel and Navi. That's the area of the biblical city of Ramah. It's also where the academics believe the true location of Kever Rachel is.
Really?
And where was the Aron then?
The Aron is in Kiryat Yarim still, which is near Givon. The Aron has nothing to do with this. This is, except that it's also in Shevet Binyamin. This is the area of Ramah, house of the place. That's where, as you come into Kiryat Shmuel, or Givat Shaul. So I should say Givat Shaul is in that same area, the area of Binyamin, the northern half of Yerushalayim. Is the tribal territory of Binyamin. From there forward, you get into the next major hill is Ramah. Rachel, the famous nevuah of Yirmiyahu, Rachel crying for her children, kol b'Ramah nishma, Rachel mevakal b'na, hibachi tamurim.
Somebody tell me Givat Shaul today is not the same as Givat Shaul of Shaul.
I think it's the same area.
Yeah, Shaul was from Binyamin.
Yeah, it's the same area. Necessarily the same location.
They said it was closer to
Nebi Samuel. Because it's...
Right. Where's Nebi Shmuel?
If you look out of Yerushalayim to the north, you can see it. There's a little, what do they call it?
North of Ramat Eshkol, in the desert. It's like a
minaret.
Yeah, minaret.
Right. Yeah. You can actually see the minaret on the top of a hilltop. Yeah. It's like a single hilltop, but you can see it. It's called the area of Nebi Samuel. There's a mountainside there or a hillside there where there's five unmarked graves, which the Arab tradition refers to as Kivrei Yisrael. Yom Benun once wrote an article in which he claimed that he believed that that was the location of Kever Rachel. Because it's unlikely that Rachel Amenu
was buried
in Bethlehem or buried in Shevet Yehuda, more likely she's buried in Shevet Binyamin. But that's a... That's based on a pasuk in Sefer Shmuel. We're going to get to two chapters from now, so we'll get there. But in the meantime, Shmuel goes on the circuit journey every year. Uchuvato haramata kisham beto. And every year they would come back to Ramah. That was his home. That was his town. V'sham shafatit Yisrael. Even sham mizbeach l'Hashem. There he judged Israel. There he set up a mizbeach. Again, Shmuel, Kohen. He's not a Kohen, he's a Levi. But he serves as the Kohen. Essentially, he's the Kohen Gadol in a sense, because he's constantly bringing korbanot, he's constantly building mizbechot. He's the only, in the aftermath of the destruction of the Mishkan, he's the only one to whom they turn to lead in the context of avoda of korbanot. He's the Navi, that we established back in Perek Dalet, and he's the Shofet. And in that regard, he combines three roles that only one person in Jewish history has ever before him combined. And that's Moshe Rabbeinu, who in the Shivat Yimei Miluim served as the Kohen Gadol, who in his role as the military leader of Israel, taking them through the desert, served as the Shofet, and in his role as the Navi Shebenevi'im, served as the Navi of Israel. This is the clearest parallel we have to the role of, or the comparison between Moshe and Shmuel. That comparison we talked about last week a little bit. I just want to show you two psukim. I think you have the source page I gave out last week. If you don't have it, I'll give you. I have four copies of it left. You're going to have to share those. Somewhere towards the top, I think it's sources. I don't have them numbered here. 2, 3, and 4. Sorry, sources 3 and 4, two psukim from various places in Tanakh that link Moshe to Shmuel. Interestingly enough, one we say every Friday night is part of Kabbalat Shabbat, which is the fourth one. Moshe ve'Aaron b'cho'anav. Ushmuel b'ko'eshemo korim al Hashem v'hu ya'anem. Moshe and Aaron in their service as Kohen, which is interesting, it's in the singular, right? Moshe and Aaron in their service as Kohen. Moshe was also a Kohen. Moshe is a Navi v'Aaron b'ko'anav, if you want to look at it that way, but there on the one hand individuals to whom would call out to God and God would answer, each in their own fashion. Moshe through Nevuah, Aaron through the Avoda of the Kohen Gadol, and Shmuel, b'korei Shemo, as he would call out in God's name. As we've seen in this chapter several times, Shmuel praying on behalf of the people, Shmuel building a Mizbeach, Shmuel bringing a Korban, Shmuel standing and praying on behalf of the people as they're going into battle. Moshe v'Aaron b'chohanav, u'Shmuel b'korei Shemo, korim al Hashem v'hu ya'anem. Moshe, Aaron, and Shmuel call out to God, God answers them. That's the paradigm of tefillah, the paradigm of the relationship, the closeness between God and the a human being, as close as that can be. Moshe, Aaron, and Shmuel in one breath.
So is Shmuel related to them?
Not Shmuel's right. A Levi.
Yeah.
But he's a direct descendant of Korach, in fact.
Korach. Wow.
Yeah, that we talked about at the beginning of last year. The dynamic of Korach and Shmuel. Yirmiyahu Perek Tetvav is the other source. Vayomer Hashem Elai. im ya'amod Moshe u'Shmuel lefanai, ein nafshi ala am hazeh shalach me'al panai v'yetzeu. In a moment of anger, remember Yirmiyahu is accompanying the Churban, in the moment of anger to Moshe, to Yirmiyahu, God says to Yirmiyahu, I will not heed this people, I will not listen to them, even if they were led by Moshe and Shmuel. So the context of the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, less issue for now, but in that one breath, again, Moshe and Shmuel, if people were led by the two greatest Nevi'im of Jewish history, Moshe and Shmuel, this would not change their fate at that moment.
See why we were exiled.
So, again, parking aside for a moment, the context of the statement by God to Yirmiyahu. But what you do see, is this recurring theme of the link between Moshe and Shmuel. Since this is the last parak of Shmuel's story, it's important to pause for a moment and sort of understand. What did Shmuel achieve that made him so significantly different from almost any other Navi / Shofet or Melech of his time, to the point where the comparison, the equation, is to Moshe Rabbeinu? That's an amazing statement, especially when you consider the fact that the Torah states unequivocally at the last pasuk, "V'lo kam od Navi k'Moshe b'Yisrael," never again would there be a Navi like Moshe. True. Nobody's suggesting that Shmuel's role was equal to Moshe, but that there is a comparison and a parallel, I think, is really a tribute to Shmuel's greatness, which, because there's so little about Shmuel's story, is hard to see without digging beneath the surface.
Also, the whole thing that this really is like a wrap-up of Sefer Shoftim.
Right.
Which is basically a big fat failure.
Correct.
It ends on a high note.
Yeah, correct. He actually, you know, pushes Plishtim out and brings Israel back to Tshuva.
Correct. Shmuel has achieved that which Sefer Shoftim had failed to accomplish. And I think it's important to note that really this is the seal, if you will, the end of the period of the Shoftim, the transition between the period of the Shoftim and the period of Melucha. We are sitting right at the cusp of the transition between the end of one era and the beginning of the another era, if Shoftim was the era of the Mishkan and Melachim is the era of the Mikdash, to look at it from the perspective of the place of the Shechina, right, Shmuel is really the end of that era. We're at that transition. If you look at the beginning of the next parak, opening Psukim of Parak Chet, Vayi Kasher Zaken Shmuel, we're shifting time periods. Now let's jump ahead. Shmuel's life is coming to an end. He's old. Vayasamet benav shoftim liYisrael. He appointed his children shoftim over Israel. We'll talk about that at length, Bezrat Hashem, next week. Vayishem beno abochor Yoel v'shem Mishneu Aviyah shoftim beVeir Sheva. His children were shoftim in Beir Sheva. V'lochu benav b'drachah v'yitu achrei abatzah v'yikru shochad v'yitu mishpat. Children are not necessarily living up to the standards we would expect of them. We'll talk about that at length. And we come to Pasuk Dalet, Vayitkapzu kol ziknei Yisrael, Vayavoo el Shmuel haramata, Vayamru elav, Hinei ata zakanto, Vanecha lo ochu bedrachecha, Ata asima lanu melech l'shofteinu kechol hagoyim. Shmuel, you're on your way out, your children are nothing to write home about, we need a melech. We're going to talk extensively about the request for a melech. It's the major theme for this year's syllabus of discussion, but just from the opening psukim, we realize that we are in that transition moment. End of Shmuel, beginning of Melucha, this is the end of Sefer Shoftim. So it's really a moment to pause and ask ourselves, what did Shmuel accomplish and why, and how was he successful where everyone else failed? What was his formula that nobody else was able to do, that he was able to accomplish? And that puts him into the comparison to Moshe Rabbeinu. There were technical comparisons to Moshe that we talked about a little bit, I think, last week. The notion that he grew up not in his parents' home; he grew up under the leadership of, in Shmuel's case, in Eli, by Eli, in Moshe Rabbeinu's case, in the palace of Paro. that called out to God, the notion of being ne'eman, being loyal. Navi ne'eman at the end of Navi ne'eman Shmuel Navi LaHashem. Shmuel was loyal as a Navi to God. Moshe is described as Mechol Beiti ne'eman, who all kinds of technical comparisons between them. But at the core, Moshe was the end of Galut, the beginning of Geula, right? Moshe was essentially a leader who took us from one major period of time to a new major period of a relationship with God. Tzit Mitzrayim, Brit, Mamre HaSinai. Nothing about the Jewish people subsequent to Moshe looked anything like the Jewish people prior to Moshe. I think at that level, that's the core comparison to Shmuel.
There's another comparison. The other way is, if there hadn't been Moshe, B'nai Israel wouldn't be there, and at least you can make the argument that if Shmuel hadn't come on the scene, Israel would have gone away.
Continued to flounder.
Would have been taken over by the Canaanites or the Philistines.
No question. Go back to the core issue of Sefer Shoftim. Where did Shmuel succeed where the other Shoftim fail? So let's go back to the core question. What was the major point of departure from which, as we entered into the land of Israel, we began to take a path that was not the path that God wanted us to take, to the point where, at that point, everything that happened subsequent is a kind of holding pattern to hold us in place until we got back to where we needed to be? You understand my question?
Yeah, but it's sort of like Moshe, where B'nai Israel cry out to Hashem from their oppression, and God answers them and sends Moshe. Here, they also have that longing. I forget, not that long ago, they had the longing, and Shmuel said, you have to get rid of your idols, and you have to...
Right, so we'll talk about the idolatry, but that's only one part of the picture. There's other Shoftim who also managed to achieve a spiritual removal of idols and idolatry, etc. So, in what made Shmuel's accomplishments not only quantitatively but qualitatively different than all of his predecessors? That's ultimately the question. So, what I want to do is actually go back to the beginning of Sefer Shoftim and look at that point of departure, because I think if we can see that point of departure, both there and in Sefer Bamidbar, can see what this parak is pointing to, I think we'll see the connection. So let's go back to Shoftim Perak Bet for a moment. Let's do first a quick summary of Perek Aleph. Quick summary of Perek Aleph, in short, is a listing of all of the Canaanite peoples, cities, or areas that B'nai Israel essentially left unconquered. That's how the chapter begins. It's a one-chapter summary of the latter 10 chapters of Sefer Yoshua. Okay, just to give you a picture. Sefer Yoshua, from chapter 1 through 12, is a description of Yoshua's conquest of Israel. It ends with the famous Shira, Song of the Kings of Canaan, that they conquered. Yoshua chapter 13 begins, V'Yoshua Zaken Baba Yamim, Yoshua is old, V'Aretz Nishara harbe me'od l'rishta. The land remained very much unconquered. So much as Yoshua had tried to get the people to conquer the land, to settle the land, and to create this idolatry-free zone that the Torah required, it remained for the most part unsettled. The Israelites settled in the mountains, the Canaanites are on the coast, for the most part, with some exceptions on both sides, and that's the remaining chapters of Yoshua is a description of what they did and what they did not conquer in great detail, with a listing of every city. Shoftim, chapter 1, summarizes all of that in one chapter. So the real story begins in chapter 2. Let's go back to the beginning of chapter 2. Vayal Malach Hashem min Gilgal al Bochim. So Malach comes from Gilgal to Bochim, which is wherever they are, but it'll be called Bochim because of the crying of the people after the Malach, after this Navi's message. Vayomer, Ale etchem b'Mitzrayim, mevi etchem al haaretz asher nishbati l'avotechem. I took you out of Mitzrayim, I brought you to the land that I promised to your forefathers. Va'omar lo afer briti etchem le'olam. I said I would not abandon my covenant with you for eternity. That provided one thing. V'atem lo tichlutu brit l'yoshvei haaretz hazot. As long as you do not make a brit with the local population. You must destroy their altars. You didn't listen to me. Therefore I said, I will not remove them quickly. I will leave them for you. They will be a thorn in your side. Their gods will be a stumbling block before you. In other words, there's a connection here between two things, namely,
You didn't conquer. You didn't do what you were supposed to do, right?
So there's a tit for tat a little bit, but in the context of the danger here, there's two different issues addressed in this nevuah that are converged.
One is that they didn't conquer the Canaanites, and the other is that they went after their gods. They
right.
didn't separate their
there's
gods.
There's the political physical issue of the brit with the Canaanites that they were supposed to conquer and either remove or demand that they abandon their idolatry, but let's leave it on the pshat level to remove from the land. And there is a spiritual issue here of the potential influence of these Canaanite cultures into their idolatrous world. They will be for you a thorn in your side, irk you, sword. Thorn and sword are essentially compared. And their gods will be a stumbling block for you. You will not be able to resist the temptation of their idolatries. Baal HaNashtarot is a very powerful, very tempting, very enticing cultural arena. And that's why the Torah demanded of us an idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel. When we failed to get rid of the nations, we, by definition, exposed ourselves to the idolatry that would come with them. That goes all the way back to the mitzvah, to the mandate in the Torah that also linked these two. This isn't a new concept. The linkage between the creation of a brit, the violation of making a brit with the local inhabitants, and the violation of the exposure to the potential idolatrous influence of the local population is set for us back in the Torah itself. Take a quick look in Bamidbar Perek Lamed Gimel. Starting with Pasuk Nun, the end of Perek Lamed Gimel. Page, I don't know, but it's
205.
Vayedaber Hashem Moshe be'arvot Moav al Yarden Yerecho le'mor. Daber b'nei Yisrael marta lehem, ki atem ovrim et Yarden el Eretz Kanan. God said to Moshe, arvot Moav, you're crossing over the Yarden, you're coming into the land of Kanan. V'hashtem et kol yoshvei ha'aretz mipnechem, remove, conquer the local inhabitants before you. V'ibadetem et kol maskiyotam, et kol malzalmei masechotam te'abedu, v'et kol bamotam tashmidu. Your mandate is to remove the idolatry. You cannot allow the cultural remains of their idolatry to be there to create the curiosity, the inquisitive nature, even so much as a remnant of these idolatries have to be destroyed. No museums.
Right, said, but he also said they had to drive the people out, drive the Canaanites
out of the land. That's the next. That's exactly the point. That there's a link between the two. You have to destroy the idolatry and drive the population out. We talked at length the last 2 years about the morality of the question as to whether or not there was a third option, which the Rambam says there was. There was a third option. It was not so much to convert them, because you're not converting them to Judaism, but to the abandonment of idolatry. They had to accept what we call the Sheva Mitzvot Nenach, which is essentially an abandonment of idolatry. Then they could stay. Without rehashing everything that we talked about, there's an important link to recognize between ancient pagan idolatry and immorality. Because ancient idolatry was a culture that was fraught with immoral behavior, including virgin rape and sacrifice, child sacrifice, murder. It was an inherently immoral type of pagan ritual, and there's a direct connection between the two. It's not just the fact that they're worshipping other religions, it's the fact that those other religions were inherently immoral. And you have to recognize that link, otherwise it's really hard to understand the Torah's vehemence against these cultures. You conquer the land, settle therein. You'll divide the land by lots. Divide the land according to the tribes. Divide the land according to lots. Divide the entire land according to the tribes. What happens if you don't drive out the population? What happens if you allow them to stay, make a breach with them? Those who will remain will be lesikim be'enechem ulitzninim betzidechem. They will be thorns in your side. Again, the analogy to the prick of the thorn, but also to the sword that they bring. They will make trouble for you on the land. And then I'll punish you, I'll do to you what I wanted to do to them. So you have, in this paragraph, you see already the connection between the mandate to destroy not only the nations, to remove them from the land, but the idolatrous culture that they leave behind also has to be destroyed, because the potential is for them to be both a military threat to you as well as a cultural and spiritual threat. That's precisely what happens in Sefer Shoftim. That connection is the core of Sefer Shoftim. If you go back to Shoftim for a moment, to Perek Bet, we read the nevuah of the Malach, or the Navi, who tells them this is exactly what's going on. You've allowed these nations to remain. They will become thorns before you in your side, and their gods will be a stumbling block before you. There's a correlation between the two. The result of which is the famous description of the cycle of Sefer Shoftim, which is described in a little bit further down the Perek, Pasuk Yud Bet, Yud Aleph, V'yasu b'nei Yisrael atara b'nei Hashem. They did evil in the eyes of God. They began to worship Baal. They abandoned God. Remember Shmuel's comment to them that they have to both abandon Baal and return to God alone. It's a reversal of this statement. They abandoned God. They went after other gods. After the gods of the nations that were surrounding them. And they bowed to them. They angered God. They abandoned God. And they worshiped Baal and Ashtoreth. Shmuel's campaign to rid them of Baal and Ashtoreth and return them to God exclusively is a direct reversal of these psukim. Israel, God was angry at Israel. He gave him into the hands of their enemies. Their enemies would destroy them. They could not stand before their enemies anymore. And as they would be conquered, as they would be oppressed, they would cry out, Pasuk Tet Zayin, skip Pasuk 2, 16, Vayakem Hashem Shoftim, God would appoint judges, Vayoshium Miad Shosehem, who would save them from the hands of their oppressors, Vakamal Shoftim Lushameel, but at some point or another they wouldn't listen to the Shoftim either. As God would appoint this shofet, God would be with the shofet, he'd be successful, save them from the hands of their enemies, kol yemei shofet, as long as that shofet was around. God would have mercy and compassion over Israel because of their oppressors, because of their cries. However, the Shofet would die. They would return to their evil ways. Not only would they return, but they would be worse than their fathers, partially because each iteration the idolatry got worse, but also because each iteration is blamed for not having learned the lesson of the previous generation. God would be angry. God was angry at them. They abandoned my brit. They abandoned the covenant with God. And then the rest of the story continues.
For a good example of history repeating itself over and over again.
Tushmo.
Tushmo. What's the? I mean, I know it means God's angry, but what's that? Where's the root of that word?
That's a long conversation. That's a long story in Chumash. It goes all the way back to Chumash. Erech apayim meicha af. The nose plays a role in the symbol of anger, or the.
What's yachar mean?
Yachar is to blow. Yachar af. You blew, as if, you know, the analogy is huffing, right? You get angry, but it's a very anthropomorphic description. Till Shmuel. What happens to Shmuel? Shmuel does something that the other shoftim never really properly understood. They are shoftim that demand the tshuva from the people, and they're shoftim that led the people into battle against their enemies. The shofet's role in Sefer Shoftim is described as a military leader who led the people against their enemies in God's compassion for his people. What Shmuel does that the shoftim, that his predecessors never did,
is it the itinerary?
He gets rid of the idols.
That's subsequent to, but in part, gets rid of the idols, true. So did Gidon, to some extent. So did Devorah and Barak, right? Sitting under a tree, judging Israel, Tachatom and Devorah.
He went to the people,
they didn't come to him. Devorah's symbolism, contrast to Shmuel, is very important here, true. It goes more than that. Go back to the description of the process of purification from idolatry that we talked about last class. Well, 2 weeks, I think, before Sukkot, actually.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago. It's on tape. Right? With the depth and breadth of Shmuel's campaign to remove the idolatry from the land. It wasn't just about his territory. Remember how we talked about in Shoftim, how each Shofet was essentially territorial, tribal leader. The description of Shmuel as an itinerant Shofet meant that he wasn't just a Shofet for his people. He went north, south, and the description here is much narrower than it really was, but he really went the length and breadth of the people. He's going to them. He's bringing the message. The Korban Pesach that we talked about in the days of Yoshiyahu, where Yoshiyahu went all the way up north into the land of Naphtali, into the land of Dan, the land of Asher and Zvulun. And then the Navi concludes, no Pesach had been brought like this since the days of Shmuel and Navi. The campaign to rid the land of its idolatry wasn't local and it wasn't tribal. It was national. It was global. It was to the length and breadth of the country to create that which the Torah had demanded of us from the word go, which was an idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel. But that in itself is not even the full picture. That's half the picture. But Shmuel does something else that his predecessors never understood.
Sounds like he unified them in some way that they didn't get. Like the others, they stayed more tribal.
The others were tribal. He was away. He wasn't connected to any tribe.
True. Others were local and he's national. And he's, that's in a sense a little bit more analogous to the Melech role than the Shofet role. But even more so, in terms of Sefer Shoftim, Mayishpotet Yisrael, in terms of the model of Sefer Shoftim, he does something which his predecessors did not fully understand, which was, not only did he remove the idolatry from the land of Israel, north, south, east, and west, but immediately upon its removal, he then set out to address the core of the issue, which is the Canaanites. It's until you address the problem, until you address the root of the problem, which as the Torah sets it out, Yosef Yeshua sets it out, Shoftim sets it out, which is the influence of the Canaanites as a local population and the internal influence of Baal as the Canaanite deity of fertility and rain, indigenous to the land of Canaan, until you remove the Canaanite influence, then all you're doing is a band-aid for a generation. So for that generation, you've addressed the problem. And then what happens to the next generation? Right. You haven't addressed the problem.
How did he do that?
So how did he do that?
Did he drive them out of the land?
Because the moment he finishes the idolatry, go back to the story. Go back. We have one chapter of all of the whole story of Sefer Shmuel, but that one chapter is exactly, I think, the core of the issue. What does he do at the beginning of this chapter? What's the first five, six psukim of this chapter focusing on? Chapter 7. What's the first half of the story? Serve God, serve all your heart, remove the idolatry, etc. Read much bigger campaign, three chapters long, Sefer Yoshua, in Sefer Malachim. And then, Yatzel etchem yad plishtim. And then he'll save you from the hands of the plishtim. And when he finishes with the hands of the plishtim, when he finishes fighting in Eben Ezer, taking the people on the campaign that removed the Plishtim influence from the land of Israel, what does he do? He turns to?
The Amorites.
Vayhi shalom ben Yisrael ben Amori. So I don't, that's sort of what's driving my hesitation to look at it just as a function of the Amorites were afraid of Shmuel because he was so powerful and they kind of kept a low profile. I think it's much more than a low profile. I think Shmuel turns his attention to all of the cities. Kol gatoshov neharim mi'akron v'ad gat v'ad kvulan etzil Yisrael mi'ad plishtim v'ayehi shalom ben Yisrael ben Amori. There's Shmuel turns to an address, which is at the root of the issue of idolatry, are the Canaanite influences of idolatry. The plishtim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Jebusites, you name it. So you need to address that piece of the story. It's not an accident that from the day of Shmuel, Baal and Ashtoreth as a cultural powerful influence in the land of Israel will never resurge until
the division of the kingdom.
Later. Shmuel, that's true. To some extent, Shlomo HaMelech in the palace, to some extent, but even that fits into the context of what we're about to go, but really as a national problem of a cultural influence of Baal in the land of Israel does not recur until Achav. And Achav brings it in because
his wife.
Of course.
Achav brings it in because of Izevel, and Izevel is a foreign queen. She's a foreign princess. In other words, the Baal will return to the land of Israel only when it comes in from
outside.
The outside. as an indigenous cultural force in the land of Israel, it's gone. That's where Shmuel's address to the core of Sefer Shoftim was, that he addressed the two issues together. It wasn't just either the idolatry, remove the idolatry and pray to Hashem, okay, God, now save us, or deal with the conquest of the Canaanites and the indigenous populations. It was both. And that's a formula that really was unique to Shmuel. To address, go back to the core of the issue, back to square one, this brings us to, in a sense, the pinnacle, the accomplishments, the fix, the address of the problem of Sefer Shoftim from the word go.
But it seems like the other Shoftim never attempted that for some reason.
Again, so it's either because of their own smallness of the moment,
or the
tribal limitations, or their own focus, or the Mishkan calamity, right? In other words,
the circumstances
made it. There's a book that was recently published by Aaron David Miller, is his name, called Why America Will Never Have and Doesn't Want Another Great Leader. Just came out, beginning of October. Interesting book. His thesis is that greatness is a function of two things. It's a function of a great person, or a person with potential, but it's also a function of great crisis. And you can't really have greatness in a time of small crisis, because you don't create greatness is a function of responding to great crisis. You don't want the great crisis, and therefore you don't necessarily want the great leader. That's the substantive thesis of his book. That's in part what's going on here. The great crisis here is the destruction of the Mishkan. We've been happy without the destruction of the Mishkan, but it's out of the ashes of that crisis that Shmuel rises to greatness. And I think that that's partially why Shmuel is able to do that which the other Shoftim are never able to do, to become this national leader. He starts from a different position. He doesn't start as a Shofet. Compare Shmuel for a moment to Yiftach. Okay, that's not an accident. Yiftach is the lowest end of the spiral. Shmuel is the pinnacle of the spiral. Yiftach,
he didn't want the job.
Right? There's no point of comparison between them. He's a Shofet and he's a Shofet, but Yiftach starts as a renegade and Shmuel starts as a Navi. Shmuel starts by growing up in the Beit HaMikdash together in the Mishkan under Eli's leadership, sleeping in the Kodesh, or possibly even in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and hearing Nevuah from a Kodesh Baruch at the age of three. And now he's leading the people on a campaign to remove idolatry and to remove the nations that are the cause of the idolatry. That's the power of Shmuel. That's the leadership connection to Moshe. Because the only other person who essentially was able to create that kind of new leadership, new people, new generation, bridge with God, abandon the idolatry, get rid of the idolatry of Egypt, even to the point of fighting Chayta Egel, that's Moshe's greatest moment is his response to Chayta Egel. And so the power of him, both as a Navi and as a leader, and the new era that he ushers in. We've now essentially reached the point where we should have been when we entered into the land of Israel at the end of Yehoshua, or at the beginning of Yehoshua. We're there. We took a 400-year detour, but we're there. And what's the mitzvah in the Torah to do when we entered into the land of Israel and we are... have dealt with all our enemies from around us, and we're in the land, and we're living in peace and tranquility. What's the mitzvah in the Torah next? Beit HaMikdash. But before you can build the Beit HaMikdash, you have to do something else first. Point A.
King.
Right, that's the mandate of the Torah. It's in Sefer. It's in Parshat Shoftim, which is different from Sefer Shoftim.
Yeah.
That was only after the people asked for it.
We're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
That's part of the issue we're going to talk to. There's a major debate amongst the Mefarshim. We're going to address that question. But the Rambam, for whom, for all intents and purposes, and all issues related to Malchus and any issue of halacha outside of the four volumes of the Shulchan Aruch, we paskin like the Rambam paskins that Malchus was a mandate. It was a positive mitzvat asay mandated upon the people when they entered into the land of Israel. And the phraseology in the Torah is, I'll show you, it's in Devarim Perek Yud Zayin. Devarim Perek Yud Zayin, chapter 17.
And what pasuk?
14.
Devarim what?
Perek Yud Zayin.
14.
Yud Zayin. So we just stand the transition. Parsha Shoftim start is a parsha that deals with models of leadership. So it starts with the leadership of Shoftim. Shoftim is Shoftim titen lecha b'chol sherecha. Establish judges in all your gates. And then Pasuk Yudalad states the following: Ki tavo el haaretz asher Hashem alekecha neten lach. When you will come into the land which God will give you, v'irishta, you will conquer it. V'yashav taba, you will live there, settle it. You've conquered it. You've settled it. 7 years of conquest, 7 years of settlement, the end of the 14 years of Yoshua should have gone from that to Melech. Melech. Instead of 14 years to establish Malchus, it took us 400 years. Why? Because we never finished the V'yarashta V'yashavtaba. We never finished the conquest of the settlement because we were always stuck in that cycle for 400 years. But when you finish that cycle and you're living in the land and you've got sovereignty in the land and you're in control and not the cultural influences surrounding you, then there's a mitzvah to appoint a king and to establish Jewish sovereignty over the land of Israel, over the entire land of Israel. That's precisely what we've got right now. Shoftim Perek Zion, Shmuel accomplishes that which Sefer Shoftim set out to accomplish. The people come to him and they say, it's time for a king. Now,
Shmuel resists.
There's much to be said about Shmuel's resistance, God's resistance, what happened, what was derailed. But from the outset, there is the model of all that Shmuel accomplished. And had we gone from Yoshua to the accomplishments of Shmuel, to the establishment of Malchus, to this building of the Beit HaMikdash, that was the goal. That was the picture the Torah set out. Chazal's a remarkable statement in the Gemara that says, "Ilu lo chata Yisrael, had Israel never sinned, then the entire work of Tanakh would have comprised of six books." Yeah. Had Israel never sinned, Tanakh would have been comprised of six books. Chameshet chumshet Torah v'sefer Yehoshua mipnei erka shel Eretz Yisrael. That's it's a statement in the Yerushalmi. Had Israel never sinned, they would have received six books. The five books of the Torah and Sefer Yehoshua as a tribute to the land of Israel. Enter the land, conquer the land, settle the land, leadership, Malchus, Beit HaMikdash. That's the sequence. We never got there. It took them 400 years to get to Shmuel. Then we got to Malchus. That also derailed, because instead of going for Malchus, we went for all kinds of other issues that took us to Shaul, which took us eventually to David, and eventually to Shlomo, and then to the Beit HaMikdash, and it took us four generations to get to the Beit HaMikdash, and then we split the kingdom. I once told you, Tanakh is not a happy-go-lucky book. If you're looking for happy endings, this is not the book to read. Because it's not a book with a happy ending. It's a book with the end. It ends with Chorban.
Do we have any happy books?
But there's okay,
not exactly right? Happy.
But there's a reason for that, because Tanakh is a record of where we went wrong. Positive reinforcement doesn't exist in the time of Tanakh. And if you want positive reinforcement, it says the people worshipped God all the days of, or there was peace all the days of Shmuel, or the hands of God was against the Plishtim all the days of Shmuel. That's it. That's 400. That's another 50 years of peace and tranquility, but that's one sentence. we don't the Navi doesn't go into lengthy descriptions of when we did
good.
Yeah. Good. He tells us all the details of what, so we can learn from our mistakes. But that's where the transition lies.
And we don't learn from our mistakes.
We should.
We're human.
Well, that's where we.
That's a human failure.
That's why, despite all of its negative picture, we still study Tanakh. Right? We still look at Tanakh. We still read Tanakh. Because hopefully we'll learn from our mistakes. All right, we're going to adjourn here. Zat Hashem, next week we'll start with the story of Perek Chet. And we want to. It'll take us a while to get to Kingshem, but we have much to discuss at the beginning of Perek.